Hi, you are listening to the 2014 Flow Conference Podcast. The following recording was made during the third core conversation entitled TV or Not TV, the Future of the Television Industry. Enjoy.
A round of applause to Elisa and Mary Beltran for what they've done to pull us together. Along with all the grad students who have done an amazing job and have been repeatedly recognized and need to be recognized yet again. This has really been a successful couple of days. And I couldn't be happier to be up here with this panel to have a core conversation, our last core conversation. And it's a suitable wrap-up for this event in terms of, you know, thinking and talking about the future of television. What I've asked the panel to do after I give very brief introductions is for them to talk a little bit more about their backgrounds, how they got where they are, and particularly I'm interested in having each of them give us a sense of where they think things are at this moment. So before we, you know, talk about the future, let's get a sense of what each of them thinks is the kind of state of the industry and the state of the art, the state of the business at this particular moment. So I'm going to start on the end and just move over very quickly. And three of these guys are UT, by the way, as fate would have it. No accident, but. And including the first of our panelists, I'm going to introduce Rob Thomas, who's got a pretty remarkable track record, I think all of you know. The Veronica Mars sensation most recently, going back and more recently. And he's now triangulating between LA and Vancouver and Austin, working on a new series that he's got up and running, iZombie, which is we're all very excited about. Next to him is Kevin Beggs, who is the chairman of Lionsgate Television. I think we're all aware of what a force Lionsgate has become in the television world in the last over the last several years. Judy Trabulsi, another UT ex, by the way, an RTF major back when there weren't many of them, and even before I got here, which just dates us both a bit. Judy is one of the founders of GSD&M, the big ad agency here locally, and one of the biggest ad agencies, obviously one of the world, one of the real players in the world of advertising on a global basis. Another UT grad and a terrific supporter of the program, and he asked all these people to come, and they all said yes. And that's Jordan Levin. Jordan Levin, grad of the program of a couple of decades back, but still around a lot and in heavy contact. Ran the WB for a number of years, has done various other things. Most recently, has become the executive vice president of Xbox, the Xbox Entertainment Studio, and there's been some churn there, and we'll talk about that perhaps as we go. And to my immediate left is Kevin Reynolds, Kevin Riley, who is immediately the former chairman of Fox Entertainment, and both he and Jordan are, I think, particularly well-positioned to talk about where they think things are going because they are, right now, I think, professionally in some pretty significant ways deciding what to do next and having both done some pretty amazing things to this point. So as I said before, what I'd like each of you guys to do, we'll start with Rob, is just give us a sense of kind of where you've been, how you got here, and where you think things are at this particular juncture.
Sure. I got my start writing young adult novels. I started when I was 28, 29. And television sort of found me happily through my YA books. And my first job in television was back in 98, 97. The first season of Dawson's Creek was my first job. And in fact, the first network executive I met was Jordan back at that time. My second year in television, I got my own show on the air on ABC, the show called Cupid, back in 1999. And then I had the good fortune of David Kelly wanting me to run his next show, at which point I got offered a really big overall deal at 20th Century Fox. I got the last one They don't exist anymore. So as we talk about, that's not true, but they used to hand them out like to anybody. And because I had had one, at that point I had gotten one show on the air, and the biggest name in television wanted me to run his new show. And then I got in this overall deal and had 4 solid years of failure in that overall deal, soul-crushing, my mid-30s sort of given to getting nothing on the air. And I had this idea for a teen show about a teen girl, Private Eye, that I actually wanted to pitch, but I was told no one would be interested in at the time, so I waited until the end of my overall deal. And I was ready to move back to Austin and go back to writing young adult novels when UPN bought Veronica Mars. That kept me in L.A. And that was a show that I had written on spec, which taught me a very important lesson. And then the next partners of mine and I sold a pitch to HBO for a show called Party Down. They hated the project. We resold it to FX. They actually loved the project, but at the end said no. And then we shot it in my backyard and ended up selling the finished project. To Stars. The irony of all this for me, and as we talk about the future of television, is, I mean, this has been a very good week for me. If you go to the front page of Hulu, Party Down is on the front page. If you go to the front page of HBO Go, Veronica Mars is on the front page. These are both shows canceled many years ago. I can't believe that we're still getting to do them in some way. And so there's a recycling going on that has benefited me quite a bit, is benefiting me right now. Currently, I've got a new show for the CW, so I am right back to where I started, working, well, I guess at the time it was WB, doing a teen show for this network 15 years after my first job on Dawson's Creek.
Where do you think things are? What's your the state of the this? And make it concise. But where are we in your view?
Well, there's never been a better time to try to make it as a television writer producer. The opportunities for to sell a show have never been better. The opportunities to get staffed on a show have never been better. There are more scripted shows going on right now. Even with Party Down, we thought we had run out of networks to pitch to. When an agent said, "No, I think Starz is going to buy original programming now," it feels like every day that you have a new avenue. There are more shows. There's a flip side to that, though. When I got started in '99, '98, with a limited number, you made more money because you were at big networks. When we did Party Down, we made almost no money on that show. So the upside downside is, yes, there are more places to sell. There's less money. There are fewer overall deals. The opportunity to go big is tougher. As a showrunner now hiring, it's also tougher. I feel like It lets in lesser writers into the business, going after the cream of the crop, because there's so many shows you're competing with for the top talent when you are hiring, that finding them, landing them, because they want to be over creating their own show on some other network. It's a real battle. There are plenty of writers in Hollywood, don't get me wrong, but they're the same number of good ones, and there are so many more shows that they're getting spread across.
All right, thanks. Kevin, thanks.
I came to L.A. after graduating from UC Santa Cruz. I was a double major in politics and drama, and was thinking about going to law school, but happily fell into teaching public school for a couple of years, and at night I was volunteering on student films and getting my foot in the door in production any way I could. And I got onto a couple of long-running shows on the production side and then landed at Lionsgate in 1998, which was a feature film startup. Doesn't matter.
TV shows.
Oh, stop.
The most
shows ever. Oh, God.
You earn back your credit.
Thank you. Thank you, Jordan. Yes. I was on a show for many, many years called Baywatch. Thank you. Thank you, Jordan. And in 1998, I got a call about a startup, a Canadian indie film company called Lionsgate that wanted to do TV. And because so much of the international revenue from Baywatch was driven by international and other ancillaries, maybe I could come up with a financial model that would work. And I joined Lionsgate, which was a fledgling company. And the only place that we could find any financial model to work with was cable, where nobody else wanted to work at the time. And over time, that seemed genius, but it was really just out of necessity. And cable, during that same 10 or 12-year period, really flourished with a lot of really great and interesting shows that we've been part of, Weeds and Mad Men and a bunch of others. And I've been there now a long time. The company has gotten much bigger, mostly growing on the film side. And on the TV side, we've simply just grown it one show at a time, two shows, three shows, four shows. So now we have kind of a stable of things, and we've kind of made our brand, if we have a brand, on launching new platforms or rehabilitating platforms that are changing. So Weeds came into Showtime at a time when they had been known for TV movies, and they were a perennial third in a two-man race with HBO, and that began a big turnaround and renaissance for them, and now they're really competitive with HBO, and last year really capped it off, or 2 years ago, getting the Best Drama Emmy for Homeland, which was the first Best Drama Best show anything Showtime ever had. And this, in the last couple of years, streaming has become a big thing, and we've tried to be in front of that with Orange is the New Black on Netflix and Deadbeat on Hulu. So for us, that becomes a kind of a defining business strategy. The deals are difficult. They take a long time. We sold Orange is the New Black in one meeting just on the title and a book, and then we spent 10 months making the deal. Longer than it took to make the entire first season of the show because the models are so tricky. But for us, that's exciting. And so to part two of that, you know, where are we? It's been described as the second golden age of television. And I think from a studio perspective and a content aggregator and hopeful identifier of great content, it is an amazing time to be in this business. And to Rob's point about the number of buyers, you know, on any given pitch that we're taking into the market right now, you know, the minimum number of meetings is 10, and the most we've ever had is 18. All legitimate buyers that could all buy the same scripted project, and generally multiple offers, some from broadcast, some from streaming, some from cable, and I don't think that's ever happened in our business, and that's really exciting, but it does put a lot of miles on your car.
Judy.
Hard acts to follow. Okay, I'm not in the content business. So I graduated from UT in 1971. So I'm definitely the oldest on this panel over here. And I loved TV. But I met my partner, my would-be partners, my junior year at UT. The dean of students back then, it was all during Vietnam, and the dean of students didn't want what happened at Kent State to happen here at UT, so he hired this group, my partners and I, to do media shows and to do research with the students on campus to make sure the university knew how we were feeling, what we were thinking, and kind of show that UT was hip. So we did multimedia shows, by the way, back in 1970, which is when we did the show. That was our first company, Media 70. Consisted of six big screens at AC Auditorium, AC 21. Six screens. We had six projectors, lots of slides, and a kick-ass soundtrack. And the first one was Values, and it started with Don't Bogart That Joint. Oh, it also cost 50 cents to get in or brownies. And when you walked in, you could tell. And so we thought it was going to run one weekend because we were charging 50 cents or brownies. And it ran like 6 weekends because the lines were like out because of we were capturing the late 60s. Buffalo Springfield, What It's Worth, y'all don't know those songs because they were decades ago. But the students loved it. And so we thought, wow, this is cool. We can do this. So anyway, we go on to graduate the following year. And that's when we knew we needed another name because it was 71. And literally started our own agency. We didn't know anything about advertising, truly. I was an RTF. Roy Spence, who is more notable now for all that he does, but he was a political science major. And then we had a mechanical engineering. Anyway, it all worked. The chemistry worked, and we had a little 100-foot square foot office on 13th and Rio Grande. And that was 43 years ago. We celebrated our 43rd anniversary on August 27th this past month. We've been fortunate enough to represent Southwest Airlines for 33 of our 43 years. They were young. We were both 10 years old at the time. We've handled MasterCard, DreamWorks, AT&T. We handle the U.S. Air Force. Now we do Walgreens. Lots of great clients, but no one thought we'd ever make it, but we stuck together. And what most people find unbelievable is that how do partnerships last 43 years? We're still all together and still doing this, although not quite as much. We've got a younger group, or else we'd still be buying all CBS, truly. And I gravitated to the media department and built the media department. We've got we're about 500 people now, and we're down on 6th Street if you've ever gone across from Whole Foods. That's where GSD&M is. I'm going to give the advertising point of view because until now, all the entertainment on TV has been ad-supported. So I'm going from an advertising point of view, and I'm going to start with where I think where it is right now, with something I learned from one of our most successful clients, and that's Sam Walton. We had Walmart in the late 80s, right when they were getting ready to expand into the bigger areas, and we had them for 17 years. And there was something that Sam Walton went to his executive group every day. It was his mantra. We at Walmart are going to give our customers what they want, not what we want them to want. He said it to his executive group, and he said it to every single store associate when he would fly around and just drop in on all of his associates. He loved his associates, and that was his mantra. Give the customers what they want, not what we want them to want. I think where we are here now is since I was in it, since the 70s, we were given what they wanted us to have, and then we got to choose between three or four networks what we want it to see. Right now, with what is happening, if you take all the networks, traditional, all the cable, but especially what you're seeing with all the technology, with whether it's Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, set-top boxes, Wii, connected TV, Apple, name it, the consumer is now getting what they want, their choice, when they want it, and on the platform that they're most comfortable with. So in my mind, it's the consumer's paradise now. There's a plethora of choices that you have. You get to pick what you love. You can watch it over and over or whatever. So that's the good news for the consumer. It's going to have a lot of challenges, though, for the entertainment side, the content side, and particularly the traditional TV.
Thanks, Judy. Mm-hmm. Jordan.
I graduated here in 89, so that's just give you some context for when I started. I started at Disney that was being run by Eisner and Katzenberg, and they were still sort of in reinvention phase, having come over from Paramount. They had turned their attention first to live-action films, then animation. When I came in, they were turning their attention to the television department. When I got there, Golden Girls was on there and Magical World of Disney, which is where Kevin and I met, because Kevin was at NBC, having to cover that, and we would roll our eyes at the wonderful magic that was coming, emanating forth from those great, great films. And I remember what I was told back then, two things, and we were talking about earlier. One was people, young adults, 18 to 34-year-olds, don't watch television, so just forget about them. You know, you need to create bimodal appeal shows, which meant, you know, get mom, dad, grandma, and grandpa, and get the kids. But people, once they graduate, college kids, once they graduate, until they get families, they don't watch TV. So don't even program to basically who I was at the time. And the second was pick movies or television, because those worlds will never cross. You either get in the movie business, and you're in that group, in that club, or you're in the TV business, you're in that club. And the TV club wasn't as sexy or as special as the movie club. And as I worked through the business, I was there for 5 years, and we grew that division into a big, you know, big studio powerhouse, and I got recruited to go over and help the WB Network start up. And I was there for 10 years and pretty much was the last man standing, so I ended up running that. And then left and started thinking about, I did a little directing, and then I wanted to start my own company. And I was trying to think about what does a production company look like. That was 2005. And I really felt like digital was going to start to be a disruptive force, and that increasingly the content that spoke more specifically to an audience rather than trying to appeal to everybody was going to be more valuable, and that the game increasingly was about how do you reach that audience, how do you develop a closer relationship between creator and consumer, how do you use digital in some cases as a means to do that. And we built a company and spent a lot of time in digital, early stuff, a lot of time doing branded content, ultimately sold that company to another digital company with a lot of channel brands, merged, acquired, all that kind of nonsense. And then a woman who used to run CBS, who I'd known, who was at Warner Brothers at the WB, she had been recruited by Microsoft because Microsoft, under Steve Ballmer's leadership, said that they wanted to start a television service leveraging the Xbox platform, which there's 90 million consoles installed worldwide, there's 50 million registered users, there's 21 million people who are paying $5 a month for multiplayer gaming and other activities. And in the same manner that Amazon was building an over-the-top video-on-demand business off of a subscription business that had nothing to do with television. In that case, Amazon Prime was a shipping business. They sort of viewed this opportunity with Xbox, especially with the new console, which functioned in some ways as a gateway for the television experience in the living room. And long story short, that effort lasted about a year and a half. I've been there for the last 6 months, and over the summer, with a new CEO, they've chosen to wind that operation down. So that is what we're currently doing. There may be some future with another company. We'll wait and see. But I'm sort of trying to figure out what I'm going to do next. And I think Judy put it really succinctly and wonderfully in terms of consumers getting more control. And, you know, and really, I think the only thing that I can add is I've always been interested in younger consumers. I always like that younger consumers aren't sort of burdened with legacy behavior. They're incredibly empowered. You know, they're incredibly bright. Millennials has been our focus at Xbox. And I just want to keep sort of going where they're going, because they're, in a lot of ways, the canary in the coal mine. And what I see happening, I think the consequence of consumers getting more and more control is that a lot of the traditional infrastructure models start to break down, because the benefits of, for example, time period start to dissipate. The benefits of marketing become really challenged. The biggest game change I've seen in the media business since I was studying it here in the mid-80s to now is social media. I think social media is the most revolutionary thing to happen to media in over a century, because it fundamentally changes the way you learn and discover and share and socialize content, as well as really anything else relevant and pertinent in your life. And the impact that social media is going to have on our business and what that's going to do is why you're starting to, I think, experience the disruption that's happening right now. I think this broadcast season for the broadcast networks is going to be very challenging, both from a business standpoint and from a viewership standpoint. I think you're starting to see that business sort of catch up to, again, declines in viewership on the financial side. And then, you know, overall, the big media businesses are playing, you know, it's starting to become more and more of a global business. And you're seeing consolidation on the distribution side with AT&T and DirecTV coming together and Time Warner and Comcast likely coming together. And that'll lead to more consolidation on the content side with big independent, quasi-independent media companies probably coming together at the same time. So I think what that'll create is a world in which there's these very scaled enterprises on the one side and these very entrepreneurial enterprises on the other side. And Kevin Riley pointed this out earlier today, but the middle starts to drop out to some degree. So it does create more opportunity, but to Rob's point, that opportunity for creators may not be the opportunity that exists in the past from a financial standpoint, but from a creative standpoint and a relationship with the consumer, that becomes really powerful. And there's no doubt that millennials, and many of you in this room, are sort of leading this sort of drive towards on-demand consumption, over-the-top viewership, cord-cutting, things of that nature. And it's going to be really interesting to see how that all plays out.
Kevin Riley.
Thank you. I'm already very interested, so I don't want to waste too much time on my story. I'll just weave it in with a broader thematic that I think is part of this discussion today, which is when I started really my career in earnest in the late 80s, I got my first break at NBC, which was, you know, at that time it was the Cosby Show and Cheers and Hill Street Blues. It was this amazing brand that was still dominant at the height of the culture. And yet it was the first time that the term dinosaur was attached to the business. And it was the first time you could begin to see, they'd say, well, this is going to be a dying business. Cable was clearly beginning to grow. No original programming, but, you know, HBO was on the premium side, and MTV, and you could see that those networks were going to continue to grow. So I was excited, and in a strange way, I was also like, well, wait a minute, I've just signed on to a dying business. And to a large degree, over many decades, they've been writing the epitaph of the death of the networks for a long time. I can tell you that at that time was the exact time when Rupert Murdoch invested in and decided to grow the Fox network by really going against conventional wisdom. If he had read the analyst reports of the time, and if he had gone with the conventional wisdom, which is this is a dying business, the entire Fox empire, worldwide empire, would never have been. So by making a counterintuitive bet at the time, nevertheless, you know, I started for 6 years at NBC. Even from the get-go, I was slightly outside the system. I came in through the production arm, where the first time the networks were going to begin to own and produce their own programming. The first show I worked on, my first show I ever developed, was a show we developed for the Disney Channel through NBC that ultimately became Saved by the Bell. That was this weird Saturday morning programming that we were going to reinvent Saturday morning. It became this crazy cult classic. Which recently, the only reason I mention that is I was talking to somebody in Silicon Valley recently, like a reporter, and he was kind of interested in everything. And I said, Saved by the Bell. And he went, you did Saved by the Bell? Like, I was like, that's my great, I guess the Sopranos doesn't mean anything. Saved by the Bell is cool. So so that was this little fringe piece of NBC. Then I did a lot of mainstream things, and then went to a company that did produce the Sopranos for HBO. We did that. And so all of a sudden we were producing a whole nother level of television for premium cable. And then I ended up in FX, which at the time, basic cable was a lot of volume, but very low rent, you know, filler, bought off network product, movies, just repeats. But they were producing some stuff, and you had to do it for cut rate. You had to produce it in Canada. they said, you know, listen, this is what it, and I didn't understand even what the success ratio was. I had never seen a rating with the decimal point on the left side of the number. And I said, well, what's a success? I don't understand what even a, what, they said, well, look, if you can get a one rating is the biggest you're ever going to do. That's what we need. And then our first show, The Shield, did a four rating, and that changed the entire paradigm of what was capable on basic cable, which basically for the last almost 15 years now has given rise to all of the great shows, Walking Dead and Breaking Bad and every other great show that's come after it. And yet that dinosaur that I've been is part of what I've been a part of that is still, after years of predicted extinction, was still going strong, driving the at the upper end of the food chain in the business. And then I found myself getting back into that dinosaur, the belly of the beast, so to speak, and ran NBC at a weird, crazy inflection point when the wheels were coming off over there, put a lot of really terrific television on, but I could really feel the business beginning to stretch finally once and for all, and then got another job in broadcast television running Fox for the last 7 years and enjoyed a lot of time at the top with American Idol and The Simpsons and House and a lot of great shows, but and Glee was an amazing ride for us, but the last few years I really felt once and for all, maybe it's time for that dinosaur is about ready to once and for all keel over to the side. And even though I had 2 years left to go, it was time for me to step out. And I'm now in the middle of that juncture saying, okay, where are we today? And it's a fascinating time, and that's why this kind of discussion is more relevant than ever. And I'm going to shut up, and we should get to that discussion.
I mentioned this at lunch and got a good reaction from you guys, so I'm going to mention it again, which is that there was a terrific panel a couple nights ago, as Horace Newcomb out here has referred to it as the old guys panel. But it was some more senior practitioners and a senior critic who seemed to agree that television really hasn't changed all that much. That really the television is pretty much the same as, you know, for Michael Zimberg and for David Melch, who's now at HBO, and we know what he's done, and for Howard Rosenberg. So what is your sense of the extent to which television really hasn't changed, or for you, what are the most significant things that have and have not changed?
That's a three-hour question answer, I guess. But my reaction when Horace said that was that their answer to that was, well, the format hasn't changed that much. And I sort of fundamentally disagree. I don't think there's been a revolutionary shift in the format, but there's been an evolutionary shift in the format. I mean, certainly we were talking about earlier, cable gave birth largely as a result of both The Sopranos and The Shield to a much more complex and sophisticated palette of narrative structure, storytelling, character development, thematic exploration, and so on. At the same time, I'd say that the timing of shows themselves has changed to the point now where if you say something's an hour-long show or a half-hour show, well, what does that mean? On HBO and Showtime, it's 30 minutes. On basic cable network, half-hour shows are now coming in at 19 minutes. And how far apart is that from, you know, shows that are being produced for, you know, by, I hate this word amateurs, but people outside of the traditional system and streaming online. Same thing goes for hours. Some are 42 minutes, some are 60 minutes. Limited series versus a long-running series where there's a clear, beginning, middle, and end over the course of 8 to 10 episodes. That's starting to shift. And lastly, I think Rob was saying this earlier, but, you're seeing it's becoming harder to define, well, what's a comedy and what's a drama? And you have a half-hour shows that are very dramatic in nature with some humor. You have a lot of hour shows that are very humorous in nature with dramatic underpinnings. I mean, so a lot of those rules have broken down, and I think the form itself is coalescing more around, on the one hand, the needs and desires of the creator to express the story the way they want to express it, and on the other side, parameters dictated by the business model of these various distribution entities, which now don't have a one-size-fits-all business model.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, you know, storytelling goes back to the Greeks, and there's a reason why we still study Shakespeare. It is the fundamentals of storytelling, of drama, remain the same, even in television format. And yet I think it would make a really interesting panel if you could ever get Shakespeare and PewDiePie on the same stage. If you know who that is, he's, you know, one of the top YouTube personalities. So on the one hand, I am very happy to say that the narrative nature of television has not gone away. I do believe that human beings just fundamentally are wired to want to tell and listen to stories. That has been since the time of the caveman, and television has a place in that. So the traditional narrative form that I think a number of years ago when the web first started taking off and gaming interactive became a more vibrant platform, there was a big presumption that the traditional television format was going to go away, and that has not. The same person that watches 2 hours of YouTube can easily toggle over to Netflix and will, and watch, you know, 5 seasons of Breaking Bad. I mean, I think you all can do that very seamlessly. It's all in the same soup. You can find different, you know, entrees of entertainment. So in the good way, the narrative has become more vibrant and not changed, but yet the platform of it, the ways of consuming it has changed massively, massively, and is going to change a lot more radically in the next 5 years.
I think also is this on?
Hello?
There we go. I think as someone who's creating shows and pitching shows, particularly when you go into a big network, there is a pressure now that you feel to have something that is very concept-driven, that you, as a writer, think about the marketability if you're going to sell to a big network, because what the big networks have going for them is the ability to tell something big. You couldn't do Lost on a small network. I think about, like, if I wanted to go in and pitch Rockford today, which I kind of would like to do Rockford, but there is no concept there. Just imagine he's a really charming man and he solves a case a week, a fairly mid-level profile case, but the guy at the lead is going to be really charming. America's going to love him. I just can't imagine trying to go in and sell that show. The pressure to make a splash right away is very intense now, and so I'm always very conscious of it. The show that I've got coming on right now, I couldn't have loved Freaks and Geeks more than I did as a viewer of television, and that was appointment television for me. And there was no concept there. I mean, other than possibly the time period, but it was telling small stories, just small story television in a very beautiful way. But when that show died, I sort of felt like, well, that's the best small story television can be. I'm not going to just throw myself into the thresher of rejection after rejection trying to get that on the air. So I'm going to try to sneak a teen show on the air. Teenage Private Eye, that's high enough concept. There's a case every week. I can sell that. And there, you know, the chance, you know, soap operas do not sell well internationally. So even as a writer now, the thought of what show can syndicate well, because I have a slightly better shot of getting that show on the air, and something that's case-driven is going to syndicate better than 90210, for example. Well, actually, in this particular case, that's not true, but for the most part, that's true. The show that I'm doing right now first of all, it's based on a DC comic. Comics are hot right now, and the concept is a hot zombie girl goes to work at a morgue, eats brains, and inherits the memories of the murdered people and helps solve crime. That's a show I can get on the air now. So the flip side of that, And something. And by the way, I this is the business that I'm in, and I love the show that I'm doing right now. So I don't say that dismissively. After working for years in broadcast television, when we took out Party Down, I can't tell you the joy when we pitched this to FX, where we had this great experience. They actually said in our development meeting, we're not trying to be the show that, we don't want you to try to be the show that 20 million people kind of like. We want you to do the show that 2 million people love. We failed on all categories there. We were the show that our close circle of friends adored. But it was liberating. It was liberating to not to be at a cable network and not have to try to appeal to everyone. After doing Party Down, which was a great experience, suddenly, you know, for the first time in my career, I had the potential to sell half-hour shows, which I my whole career had been in an hour, and I sold a half-hour to Kevin at Fox, and it was such, it was so hard to go back and try to write jokes for America rather than for my close circle of friends like I did on Party Down. It's such a different beast and one that I found really challenging.
Kevin.
Well, I mean, I think there's some truth to the form and the narrative being similar in some ways. That hasn't changed. But the access, I mean, just as there were used to be three networks that, or four in the era that those guys were talking about, there was a very few amount of gatekeepers, and there was only a few providers of content, kind of trusted showrunner, writer, creator types that were given access to that very small, limited portal of three or four. Today, with all the buyers that I alluded to earlier, there's a lot of room for new voices to get in the room. And while broadcast does still rely on big, noisy ideas, and even more so than before, there's a lot of smaller, lower concept ideas that, you know, take hold at small outlets if you can do them for the pricing that makes sense, that over time develop a lot, you know, a following. Portlandia is kind of a small show that has kind of blown up to become a big show. And even like in our little line of shows, Nurse Jackie, which was, you know, not nearly as noisy as Weeds, but it's had a nice run on Showtime and got a lot of critical acclaim and become kind of a business. And there's just so many places to go to. Every day there's a new buyer saying, hey, we want to be doing more scripted shows. Can you pitch us something? Can you bring us, you know, our Breaking Bad or our show, even for our parameters and scale? And that is unique, and that's why so many interesting people have come into TV that I think probably before were a little bit shut out of the process because they weren't a name brand supplier. That's, I think, great for the business. So it's the same but different and certainly more opportunity.
So in terms of the range of stuff out there, and, you know, Kevin, your outfit, Lionsgate, has delivered several shows that have kind of defined their respective networks. We also talked a little bit before about just how hit-driven the industry is and how hit-driven, I mean, it's obviously this the industry is hit-driven, but in terms of the relationship between a hit show and a network, and you mentioned how many new shows were on the air last year? Did you?
That was just on cable. There were
just on cable.
1,075 original shows on cable.
All right, 1,075 original shows last year, and you know, what does it take to break, you know, to break through, and how important is that relationship between a hit show and one of these many, many, many buyers, one of these many, many, many networks out there?
Well, a hit is a hits become a really relative thing. You know, I think there's some thematics here where Rob talks about this relationship between love and like. And Judy was talking about how we used to be able to sort of dictate in advertising, hey, everybody should use Right Guard, you know, and that's what you did. And we would say, this is what's on television, because there wasn't that much on, and you have to see it at 8:30 at night.
The best example of that was, I think you were probably there with Warren at the time at NBC. There was an infamous statement: Thursday night comedies were so popular on must-see TV that during one upfront, I believe it was, sort of said, you know, our star is not, you know, and our hit is not a show. It's the time slot. Our star is 8:30 Thursday night.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that time, a Thursday night made more money than the entire rest of the network combined. And it was that powerful. But there was an interesting article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, like about maybe, I don't know, 18 months ago or so, talking about that decades ago, quite often everybody could agree culturally on the best and the biggest. You know, it was Michael Jackson's Thriller. That was number one, and that was the best. You know, now maybe didn't everyone love it, but you all agreed like that was it. You know, Star Wars was it. Now, cultural impact and the ability to really hit a nerve, you know, there are shows like Mad Men that may have a huge impact, but in fact are really quite small in the larger, you know, the larger culture. There's things that NCIS on CBS, for example, is probably 20 times bigger than Mad Men, and yet it doesn't, a lot more people watch it and probably like it. They're an older demo, but it doesn't have the same ripple effect on culture. It hasn't had the same, somehow yet they share the same space. NCIS has to get crowded out by Mad Men. And in the past, you would just sort of squash that like a bug. So there's so many things. We're in a place now where I think weirdly, everybody's still chasing for the, everybody. I don't care whether you're Yahoo, whether you're Netflix or Fox, you would like to have the biggest possible thing you can get. And there's always those things in culture that weirdly, spontaneously, everyone's going to agree, we want to watch that at this moment in time. We're going to go see that movie. And there'll always will be that. You know, it was American Idol for a long time. Walking Dead, all of a sudden, a lot of people agreed was the number one show out of nowhere. Who would have ever... I bought The Walking Dead at NBC. And when he delivered it to me, at the time, Frank Darabont, I was like, wow, really? Zombies? Frank, like, how much slow walking can you have? Like, you know, and I was on my way out at that point, and I just left it there. I was like, it's good, I guess. It's interesting. And then they passed on it. But somehow, who would have thought Zombies, which was a subculture of a subculture, could become the number one show? So it's a weird thing, this hit right now. And sometimes now, it used to be, go in as broad as you can. Now, I think it's almost the inverse, which is go in as specific as you can. Hit a bullseye with people who love it, and you can usually scale from there. It's much, much harder, and yet there's still a lot of entities trying to throw the net really wide, and usually you sort of end up with something for nobody.
We saw that almost. The WB was an interesting model because it was still a broadcast model, but we saw that with almost every show that ever became really valuable to us, with maybe the exception of Dawson's Creek, which sort of hit it out of the box, I think, in large part because of Rob's involvement. But almost everything started off as the lowest rated show on television. But you would start, what we always did was we looked at the demographic breakdown, and if you saw that there was heat in and around a younger demographic, like something as narrow as, well, girls 15 to 17 love this. We're getting a 30 share in girls 15 to 17. No one else is watching it. But that's upticking every week. Okay, just stick with it. Let's see what happens. That's going to spread. Gilmore Girls, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I mean, Seventh Heaven. Like, you went through every show, same model. And I think that's increasingly where we're going. The traditional business model is whoever gets the first window pays the most for it. And I think increasingly, the first window, distribution window for content, now that there's a lot of different windows getting negotiated, is really almost going to be a marketing platform to raise awareness that, hey, there's this show out here. And then it's the on-demand platforms where that value is increasingly going to get realized, because that's where you start to catch up and binge watch and find it because you've heard about it somewhere else. And the challenge really becomes, well, who owns that show? You know, who's paying the proportionate cost for the value? I was at a dinner party the other night, and someone was talking about how great Netflix was. Person was in their 50s, not in the business, not a hardcore television viewer, but describing to someone else the wonders of Netflix, and they have all this great original programming, and this programming includes, House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, and they have this other great show called Breaking Bad. And I said, wait a sec, Breaking Bad, do you think that's a Netflix original show? And said, yeah, that is. And then everyone else, no, that's an FX show. No, it's AMC show. And I just thought, wow, Netflix is accruing all the value. AMC, you know, paid the large proportion of that, marketed it, had all, and they're not getting the ultimate benefit
for
them right now.
I mean, people are like, great, it's, oh, fantastic, I'm just going to wait for 4 seasons, then binge watch it on Netflix. Well, we got to survive 4 seasons for you to be able to watch it there. And then Netflix strips out all the branding and just kind of pushes it in with their own stuff, and you're like, wow, how amazing is Netflix? Well, wait a minute, if you're at AMC or Fox, that, what good does that do for you?
I mean, when there were three networks, it used to be this forcing mechanism because it was a race, you know, and it was every day there was a scorecard. And if you weren't winning, you were losing. And then it started to, you know, Fox started to say, we're not interested in going after everybody. We're interested in, you know, 12 to 34. And then WB came along when Fox decided to go a little bit longer and try to replicate that. And then cable started to. And now, you know, the scorecard isn't just an overnight. Now it's, it was C3, you know, last year, which means over 72 hours, how many people are watching. Now it's C7. And now, and is that even that relevant anymore? Is that just a media buying tool? I mean, there used to be a, you know, every year, you know, NBC used to have this tradition of big party. Everyone would load in a ballroom on an afternoon right before the, you know, season started. And whoever was running NBC made this big speech. And I remember one, you know, early 90s, you know, Warren Littlefield, who was running NBC and is now a successful producer, got up there.
Enough about the past.
No. I was just going to say, you know, started the firing pistol off and said, let the games begin. We're far away from that now. It's no longer a three-person race.
Judy, talk about advertising and just your sense of how important advertising obviously, you know, has been to, you know, the network model and the cable model. And just, you know, where are we now in terms of the relationship between advertising and television? And I'd love to have all you guys, you know, pipe in on this, but I want to start with Judy.
So what's happened with all the new platforms, particularly the digital ones, we're getting a lot more data about the audience than we do from the networks. Even though the networks are providing the most eyeballs, we've stopped following the shows, and all we do, our main thing is knowing our client's target audience, and we know everything about them. If we have 2 weeks to do a strategy for a media plan for our clients, 13 of those 14 days is learning every single thing, psychographics, demographics, what do they eat, what do they watch, everything we can find out about, and then it's our job to make every one of their advertising dollars return an investment on that money. Before, when it was the four of you, especially the three of you, what's funny, what's coming here, I'm going to ask something pretty soon about boomers being the biggest until the millennials came along, were driving a lot of the ratings and a lot of what was going on, because in the 70s and 80s, I could pick the top 10, Nielsen top 10, every single year, once I saw the upfronts and everything. Right now, what am I watching? Exactly what CBS has all the boomers. So what the millennials, the digital natives, the younger group, they're not following the patterns. They're not following the patterns at all. And that's why there is a little concern about, has the TV ecosystem changed? And is it changing because y'all have your own way of doing everything?
Yeah.
And you're not, it's kind of like when the boomers started turning 40, which was several years ago for me, we got a call from Wall Street Journal because it was a rite of passage when people turned 40, they started subscribing to the Wall Street Journal. They were supposed to be making money and finding out about it. So they called us. I don't know how they, and we just were turning 40, 1988, turning 40. And they called us up. We had never been to, like, Wall Street. We had never seen wood and mirrors and glass. We were going up to this thing, beautiful oak wood. And the two people that we met with were great, the editor, the publisher, the editor, and the marketing guy. And so, well, y'all are 40. Do you read the Wall Street Journal? And my partner, Roy Spence, said, no. And he said, why? And I went, there's nothing relevant in it to me. And I was about ready to crawl under one of the tables. That's not what I would have said to the client. But and so that's when the marketplace section was introduced. We said, make it, 40-year-olds aren't interested in what y'all are writing about. They want to know how the new Diet Coke, how could anything be such a disaster in a company like Coke? And so we started talking to them about the marketplace section. I have a feeling that this generational thing is driving a lot of what we're dealing with in TV, watching the habits, and the ratings. Because y'all go to YouTube as much as you go to... You go to YouTube more than probably a channel. My niece's nephews that are in the millennial thing, they've never watched Stephen Colbert on a network. They just pick the ones that he, you know, they liked and go through and they hear about it. So the challenge to us, to advertising agencies and our clients is we know so much about digital that we know that it's a very effective and efficient buy. We know that to this day, TV rules, or else why would you have the Super Bowl doing what it does, or debuts of big shows. You need TV, you need traditional TV for the eyeballs. Everybody's talking about it. Drive it with second screen. We did that with the Radio Shack commercial in the Super Bowl. Man, we knew that they were loving that call from the 80s. And so we had Command Central for Facebook, Twitter, you name it. And so we would rise to the very top. But we're having to manipulate that in different media right now. So if advertising agencies were sitting down with the networks right now, we would be saying, you can't continue to charge what you're charging for this very broad audience when all we want are 18 to 34-year-olds. And we go, and that's when cable came in and we could start even targeting there now. So I think the dilemma is going to be if Netflix is starting a trend and there continues to be no ad support for new venues, that's going to be a problem for advertisers. It's going to be a real problem for traditional TV. But they've made it since the 50s, and they've always adapted. I don't know if there's a Ted Turner out there that can reinvent like he did in the late 70s and give us all the great things like, you know, CNN and satellite TV. And he was a genius at what he did. But that's what needs to come in now.
Well, I can tell you right now, Judy, there is no magic. I mean, when you were talking about, this is a side note, but when you were talking about turning 40, I happened to be watching this great Louis C.K. thing yesterday online. It was about aging. And he was talking about when you turn 40, like when you're young and you go in and you have a shoulder problem, they'll like reconstruct your shoulder. He said, but when you turn 40, it's the first time in your age where you go in and see the doctor and he goes, yeah, you got a fucked up ankle. And they go, well, what do I do about it? He goes, well, you could take a leave, I guess. You know, they don't even try. He said they stop trying to fix you, you know? And weirdly, I think that's kind of where some of the traditional media is right now. It's like, yeah, that's pretty fucked up. Well, what are we going to do about it? Well, I don't really know. And I'm telling you, there are a lot of smart people right now going, well, you can take in a leave, I guess. You know? And yet there's, you know, an awful lot happening right now on many, many fronts. It's a fascinating time. I think it's a great time for those of you who want to go in the career because I think rules are being written right now and you can go in and there's so many different points of entry to come in and make your mark and to write some new rules.
Okay, let's open it up to, unless either of you guys, you want to talk about sponsors or delivering programs.
I know nothing about
advertising. All right, well, the business model, we did talk a lot about just, you know, what is the business model, you know, there used to be a business model, and now, you know, it's long gone. Advertising is obviously important, marketing is important, branding is important, but so let's open it up to questions. We had the tweet option, and the questions that have come from the floor have been so good the last two core conversations that I thought we'd just stick with that, even though it's a little wacky in terms of running the damn... how many microphones do we have? Running the microphones around there. We have a microphone. You know, let's open it up, questions up to the audience, and let's start anywhere, and we'll just try to keep it... We have a question right here, and then one back there. So we'll go from here to back there, and let's right here. And help out passing the mic or not. Okay.
Thanks for coming. As content curators, I guess, so for Kevin and Jordan, how cognizant are you of, I guess, with the recent stuff in the news about media portrayals and how people are being portrayed and stuff, how cognizant are you of putting out content that could be culturally significant? And then at what point does the business model and bottom line kind of trump that notion?
What do you mean by, what do you mean cognizant of putting out stuff that's culturally significant? What do you mean by that specifically?
I guess, like, so a good example for me, I guess personally, is ABC's recently putting out Fresh Off the Boat, which is the first Asian American comedy on network TV since Margaret Cho's in the 90s. So stuff like that, I guess, or just like even more, there's the idea that, you know, we have so many outlets and channels that we are getting more diverse and we have avenues that we can see more diverse programming, and yet kind of what Judy was talking about, traditional TV still at this point, Super Bowl, is the eyeballs, right? So Modern Family, I guess, is the last, what was discussed previously in a conversation as kind of the last programming that has really put it out in the ether of the American conscience of, I guess, gay rights, right? That's what I'm kind of wondering about, or when does like the splash or the noisiness triumph the quiet cultural impact that it may have? And the business decision, I guess.
That's a multi-pronged question, but I think ultimately you're trying to find this tension between sort of driving culture and being ahead of it. And to a large degree, television has, going back to Elvis Presley on the Beatles, you know, where they would only shoot him from here up because that was obscene, the way he gyrated his hips. And for every decade that followed after that, television would push things forward and sometimes cross over the line and then have this, you know, sometimes the larger culture hadn't caught up to certain portrayals or certain images that made their way onto the air. So I think to a large degree, television has been there, and yet as the country has become increasingly more you look at just demographic trends, as we've become a multicultural, we always have been a multicultural nation, but that attempt to be broad and do the biggest possible audience, I think, has also then cut out or marginalized a lot of the voice. And weirdly, on broadcast television, even though television did lead the way, you go back to some of the Norman Lear stuff and Good Times or Freddie Prinze, stuff that early Saturday Night Live, some pretty daring things decades ago, and yet weirdly in recent years some of the broadcast networks almost shied away from that because they want to be broad. Now you're seeing it come full circle where there are all these other avenues that can begin to speak to voices again and say, that reflects me, that speaks to me. And now, finally, the broadcast networks, I think, are beginning to do stuff that's a little bit more connected. But does that answer some of your question? Are you going to take a stab at it, Jordan?
I mean, I feel like it's always a struggle with business, right? And if this isn't going to get the ratings, why would we put out something that could speak to maybe a smaller audience but would be more culturally relevant? And I guess, in your mind, where is that in your head when you're greenlighting a show or when you're choosing what's going to go on a network, or in the studio case, what you're selling to networks?
Well, when we're on the studio side...
When we're considering something, because we're kind of buyers and sellers, right? We're hearing pitches and then thinking in the back of our mind, can we sell this to somebody else? But we start with, you know, is it good? You know, are we interested? You know, would we want to watch it? Now, happily, there's so many new outlets that there's definitely places that, you know, we would watch more personally than we might sell to necessarily. But for us on those kind of things, I think for the Lionsgate side, if it makes us uncomfortable, that's like the one that we actually, you know, want to jump into. And I think authenticity to us is the most important part of any of those conversations about things that are going to be provocative or awkward or And I think Weeds and Nurse Jackie and Orange, you know, they're really, they feel certainly to me, but I think a lot of audiences like really authentic portrayals of multiculturalism, and they're not always in a PC box ever. I mean, we have a comedy right now, an adaptation of a feature, a group of feature films that we have, the infamous Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle movie brand, which we sold to Adult Swim as an animated comedy, and I just saw the animatic of the pilot. It is so raunchy. I can't even believe this is ever going to be on TV. But it is so politically incorrect. It offends everyone equally. And I think it's probably going to be a giant hit, is my guess. And I really can't wait for it to be done. And I've never done animation, so now I'm waiting till January to see it again, which is insane to me. But that's like, for us, that's the sweet spot. And those are the shows that people lean in on and actually starts conversations between people. I can't tell you how many people on Orange is the New Black, much to my shock, I have a 14-year-old daughter, how many parents have said, oh, I've been watching with my daughter. Oh, how old's your daughter? 12. Like, are you kidding me? You can't put that on in your house. But it opens up conversations that mother and daughter or whatever the pairing would be would never have. No one would ever come in and talk about the subjects that are brought up in that show just on a random Tuesday afternoon. But if they were both binging on it, there's a common ground. And I think we've done our jobs if we can get shows like that out there and it doesn't feel like it's force-fed.
Very good. Another question. Now let's keep moving.
Okay, this question for Rob, and I say this as a fan of your work, but that Kickstarter campaign makes me nervous. It made me very nervous, and I'm wondering about what you think about it in terms of the future of the industry and the future of independent or studio-produced products. And the reason why it made me nervous is because it felt to me, obviously, like, of course, this was a cult-based show, and it had a very strong audience, but it was transferring of the financial responsibility to people who had a lot less money than the studios that could produce it. And so I wonder if you could speak to that decision, and also let us know if there have been any kind of ramifications in the industries that you've seen after it.
Well, this past year, sort of after years of trying to get a Veronica Mars movie off the ground, going through normal channels, I went to Warner Brothers and asked them for permission to raise money for the movie going through Kickstarter. That was not an easy thing to get Warner Brothers to let me do. I mean, first of all, you should know that they own the property. Even though I created the show, they own the name Warner Brothers. Of course, they own the name Warner Brothers. They own the title Veronica. It was a hard thing to get them to say yes. It was almost a year long process. The number of people who had to sign off. There were a ton of people over there who thought it was a bad idea for them, very much for the reason that you're listing here. What they did not want to be seen as is a big company holding this title hostage until fans shook out enough money to make the movie. The way I think we address that, and the thing that I remain proud of, if we had treated it like we were a public radio drive in which we were offering, here's a $5 tote bag that you will get for your $100 donation, then I think that would have been cheating. I think that would have felt icky. It would have been relying on sort of a charity as a way. What we tried to do was offer good value for the dollar. So I would say that 80% of the money we made were at our $25 and $35 marks, which was like for a copy of the movie when it came out, a digital download or a DVD and a T-shirt. all things that we felt were like a good price for the money. The upside of doing what we did and making the money, and by the way, we got a lot more money from Warner Brothers. They chipped in millions of dollars, so it was not like we only got the, like they were off the hook for everything else. Where was I? We delivered value. And so, yeah, what was the rest of the question? You seem still pretty upset about it.
I'm very glad to hear that Warner Brothers was against it, because I did feel like it was a kind of transferring of financial responsibility in a way, when consumers are, of course, A, much less rich than studios, and B, already paying for the product in other ways, in a ton of other ways.
Right, and now I remembered what I was going to say. Thank you. is that there's been a death of this price range of movie, this sort of $5 to $10 million movie business, and Warner Brothers is not a company that typically makes movies in that range. There would never have been a Veronica Mars movie without this Kickstarter campaign. They were never sort of bottom dollar for Warner Brothers on a movie is $30 million. There was no cost-benefit analysis in the world that was ever going to make that worth it for this company. This was sort of the one way that it could get made. I think it's going to make a little bit of money, which I'm proud of. The movie will eventually be profitable, which I think is a good thing. I wanted Warner Brothers to make money, because I want to see more movies made in this price range. I want fans of products to have more ability to put their money where their mouth is and get the products that they want made out in the world.
Yeah, I think it's great. I don't think it's scary at all. I mean, the scary thing is that a small amount of gatekeepers forever would dictate what you could and could not watch, or what was appropriate for you, which might not have been appropriate for you, or which talks to you but maybe doesn't speak to you. And now, as the consumer's in control, you have a lot of other options, to the point where you could sort of demand that you bring back a failed series. And so we're actually willing to even put our money up for that, because we think it was really worth it. We want to participate in it. And I think it creates a lot more avenues rather than few gatekeepers at the top that say, we will fund this and we won't, because actually a lot more people suffer in that way. I can't, for every bad show that I've ever canceled that I think is hideous, we would get, you know, you still forget in the world of television, that would quite often be like 6 million people still watching it. It's a lot of people. And I'd get letters going, we are never going to watch Fox again. We, our family sat around, we bonded over this show. And you're like, really? Over that show? Come on, guys, really? Please, please get a life. Well, you know what? But they're entitled to their opinion. And now, because there's other avenues, even to the point where they could fund it themselves, some of these things can live on. I think it's great.
Another question. We got several right over here, so if you just camp out right over here and just hand it around, right there.
Hi. So one of the big frustration for me is when people I know will tell me about a show that's great, or I see something that's great that I want to tell all my friends to go watch, but I'll go look for it to watch somewhere, and I don't care if it's on Netflix or Hulu or the network's website, or if I have to watch ads to see it. Like, I just want to watch it, and it's either just not anywhere, or there's only a few episodes or one season. So my question is, with the success of like digital streaming platforms and the kind of binge-watching consumption model, why isn't everything just streaming somewhere now?
Fantastic question. It's because we've taken our business problems and passed it on to you, the consumer.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, Kevin's right. The business used to be a business of saying, here's a business. It was a rare business where technology limited the ability to give consumers exactly what they wanted on their terms. So it allowed the business to say, we're going to create this business model, and we're going to impose it on you using...
Well, you had to watch it. Right. You want to watch that show? Right. You got to watch it Tuesday night.
With commercials.
And then you're going to sell. Judy's ads are going to be in it.
You're now in a position... We're now in a position where, okay, Genie's out of the bottle.
No, it's halfway out of the bottle, which is the problem.
Good point.
No, that's the problem.
There's a lot of things that are just wrapped up. I mean, basically, the reason it doesn't work is there's so many rights that have already been given away. or they're tied to multiple parties who have to give approval processes, or there's just not the bandwidth available yet in terms of manpower and resources for companies to make all these deals, because every deal is incredibly complicated. Every territory is a company. I mean, this, you should answer this question, Kevin.
This, right now, I mean, a lot of the shows you're thinking about probably are in like basic cable, so like a Walking Dead or Breaking Bad or Mad Men. Because the streaming ones, you know, they are available, like, basically forever. And the broadcasters, by and large, have their websites and are hoping that you come at all times to get you for next week to come in live in real time, because the storytelling drives you to next week. But right now, the big battleground between the cable broadcasters and the MSOs, led by Comcast, is to have the whole season up and running at any time on streaming, run of show, versus what they have this thing called the Rolling Five, right? The Rolling Five is any five at any given time, but they kind of lapse, right? So it's 1 through 5, and then it's 2 through 6, and 3 through 7, and you're going like, I don't know how the pilot started. I got to go back. Too bad. You know, get the DVD, which we don't mind on the studio side. The DVDs are pretty good. But every cable operator right now is changing the rules, the terms of trade, to have the whole season. So I think with even this year, you will see it. It's a big battle cry.
It would be a one-hour discussion and a pretty complex one to take you through, only that everybody at the companies realized, okay, we've now got a paradigm shift where we need to make these things available on different platforms to be consumed different ways. And yet, because of the underlying rights, it's insane. So it's as though we said, okay, you know what? We used to have to come in the store, buy that shirt right there off the rack, and now people don't want to necessarily come in the store. They want to buy it somewhere else. Well, we realize that would make sense, but if we do let just people come in and buy it wherever they want or pay for whatever they want, we're going to go out of business. So we created this insane matrix of, okay, well, you can come in for 2-3 days and get the shirt, but then after 3, you have to wait another month, and then it'll be somewhere else available, and you have no idea what that is. But it is because of a reason of legacy, underlying rights, with billions of dollars of implications tied to it, okay? What happens is a lot of consumers just say, the media companies are idiots. They don't understand. We should just be able to watch this stuff. Well, we get it. But when you have this legacy business that is sustaining billions of dollars, we're slowly but surely trying to do it, but the consumer behavior has raced way ahead of the business itself.
You know, and Mr. Beggs here raises a good point too, which is if you let everything out streaming all at once, what the network's going to say, well, you know what? I'm not paying as much for it. The advertising in that show is going to be less valuable. A lot of these services that are streaming don't have the advertising revenue or tools or advertising inventory to impose into a show. So then the cost gets passed on the consumer. And the question is there enough consumer demand to offset the loss from the other side? Because Rob and his group are likely, if it's something they love, maybe they'll make a little less money, but they're not going to say, okay, we're now making this for next to nothing. So it's this interesting time where at the end of the day, look, everything gets paid for by the consumer. And it's either the consumer paying for it directly or the consumer watching advertising and selling their eyeballs essentially through a middleman. So it's a process. But if you take a big step back, it's happening really quickly. It just seems slow because there's this anticipation.
Well, now there's an expectation on your half. I want to go watch a show. It should be available to me very clearly from the beginning to the end. But here's a specific that's going on that I cannot tell you how many man hours I spent on this. Netflix is a big buyer of rights. You know, they spend millions of dollars per episode to get those rights. Netflix, if you have it, works great. You can go watch from the beginning. You can watch in one day a whole season's worth of shows. So in the last couple of years, the broadcasters that put them on, you know, we have whatever, you know, whatever, pick a show, you know, Glee or something. We would say, okay, we want to be able to say from episode 1, you can watch episode 1 of Glee and then watch a whole season's worth from that season. Netflix starts saying, well, wait a minute, if you're doing that, where you on your service is going to have the entire season up all year long for people to watch it, you're stripping down my value when I buy it over there, so we're going to pay you 40% less for it. So all of a sudden, guys like Kevin Beggs, who run that business, say, wait a minute, that's my show. Netflix is going to pay 40%. Listen, network, you can't keep that episode up all season long. You're stripping out my value. So then we say, all right, well, how about if we keep it up for 5 days and then take it down, and then we put it back up, and that's where you get that crazy metric.
Well, but I...
Judy said, I'm only going to pay for 3 days worth of advertising, even though people are going to watch it for many, many more days.
But so is that what's happening with TV everywhere, with the cable companies are trying
It's bonkers. Yeah, it's... We'd have to order dinner in here.
Okay, never mind. Then don't go. they don't want to have dinner in here. Okay, all right. Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, it depends how the game goes.
True.
It may be more entertaining.
No.
God bless you, Judy.
Do I stand up? How's that work? Okay, cool. So it always seems like each kind of time period has like a dominant type of show that people watch, like a family sitcom or a cop show. And right now, is that kind of like the comic book show? Like with three of like the big four main networks have at least one comic book show, and then you're making one of like three or four on the CW, and then Netflix is getting four, and PlayStation has a comic book show. So is that kind of what's dominant and people are watching, or is that just going to end up being a fad and go away?
I don't think it's a fad. We were talking earlier at lunch, just prepping, about feature business, TV business, and, you know, the hit business, and obviously the feature film business is dominated by big, comic and graphic novel adaptations, and TV, particularly in the hit-driven piece of it, and broadcast has to have hits more than anybody to make their model work, is going down that road. And Disney's using all the assets in the Marvel family, both on Netflix and on their own air on ABC with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and the next one. And Gotham is coming, and looks like it's going to be a monster success long before it's ever even aired. Those are huge internationally. I mean, put aside comic books as a phenomenon, for the international business, high concept and genre or ideas that are fairly easily digested with or without translation or subtitling or looping are always more interesting and more lucrative. You know, the hardest sell overseas for most shows is an American comedy, although now and then one breaks out to be a huge success. And some have become giant successes. Kevin mentioned The Simpsons. Animation, interestingly enough, also breaks through international. And there's no bigger show worldwide probably than Simpsons or the CSI franchise or something like that. I mean, it's just phenomenal. So comic books, and just look at the global box office on Iron Man or Avengers or any of those shows. They're huge, and look what they do in just one territory of China. So if those shows had any of that same success, if they could even sell in China, depending on the regulatory bodies, they'll do fantastic. They'll all do great.
But things come and go over the years. I would say right now, I wouldn't say that. Comic book things are here forever. They're very robust. They may go on for quite some time, but you go back to the history of television, the Westerns were a staple, and it's impossible to get a Western going, and I don't know that we will ever more. So certain things ebb and flow. Anthologies at one time were very, very big. You cannot do an anthology right now, and you haven't in our entire careers. So, certain things come into vogue, and they may run hard and fast for a while. P.I. shows. P.I. used to be a staple of television. Rockford File, there were lots of P.I. shows. Really hard to sell and get a P.I. show going now. But we're going to see a lot of superhero stuff for the foreseeable future.
Another question.
It was refreshing to hear you talk about the ways in which the business kind of restricts our agency. There's been this kind of era of utopianism, I think, that's kind of gone over all three core conversations about the choice that we have. In the first one, it was everything. You can stream everything now. And in the second one, I think someone said, well, you just have to tell us, and then we'll put that stuff out. And then there was, now fans can get stuff made. But then now we talked about it more pragmatically, as you talked about, the number of hurdles that have to be jumped for us to get what we now kind of weirdly expect, even though it's completely unrealistic. But you started the conversation, and I can't remember who it was, by saying we're going to see huge changes in the next 5 years, 15 years. What do you not that you have a crystal ball, but what do you foresee in And is it, do you foresee things happening that take us closer to this weird utopia that can only kind of exist because you still need our money?
Using cable the way you do.
I mean, there seems to be so much choice, and yet there's a lot of consolidation. So the point about sort of cultural diversity and things of that matter, you got to remember that while much has changed, much has remained the same too, and I know I'm talking on both sides of my mouth, but there's still sort of a handful of big media companies in the same way there was a handful of big broadcasters at one point in time. And all of these networks, if you look at sort of organizational charts, you know, 10 networks sitting in NBC Universal Cable report into one person, and then that, you know, and the broadcast side reports in one person, and that reports into one person. So the filtering still happens. The relatively select group of people, and that in some ways creates an illusion of choice, but I think in some cases still creates a consolidation of power. And to me, the big tension point that's building up is very much sort of technology in the form of, you know, Silicon Valley, if you will, or increasingly the cable providers becoming broadband providers, which are inherently technology companies, and the content owners, media companies, things of that nature. And those are two, and I'm, you know, just sat in one of those companies on the technology side, coming at the business from very different places, very different cultures, very different expectations, understandings or lack thereof, real translation issues. But, again, consumers are pulling them together. And that's going to be interesting to see where does that balance ultimately land? Who ends up in what position of control? We've seen the music business largely get ceded to the technology companies. Is that going to be the same for the content companies? That's to me, is the big question.
One more comment, and we'll have to wrap it up, Kevin.
Oh, okay. I would boil that down to one word, which I think, for me, will define the future, which is discovery. And discovery in the sense that, as we all know with Google now, you can put your one Google search away from really pretty much getting any piece of information you want at your fingertips. All the large web-based platforms currently are trying to refine their discovery. You can have a great timeline on Facebook, but if you go back and go, oh, what was that great cool thing that Jordan posted 3 months ago? You can't really go back and find that archive. They're going to be working on that. The way we would offer things in the past was a very, you know, it would be on television, then it would be on syndication, then it would maybe be on a VHS tape or a DVD, then it would go away. Now, in the age of ubiquity, everything will be available. And how we organize that and create a discovery, it's beginning, you know, and Netflix is a brilliant example of it. We were talking about a show I put on Friday Night Lights that's had this incredible long tail, lived on. It wasn't a hit show in its first window. People loved it, but it was a very small rated show, but it keeps going because the discovery, as it lives on, people can know exactly how to get it, and there it is available. So as everything gets archived, so to speak, the discovery will have an original expression, which is where one of Rob's shows could come back around and be self-funded and now have a platform to live. But also everything will be sort of searchable, and the interface will be not traditional linear television. So that's a, I don't know if it was clear, but.
All right, I want to, time's up. So this has been a terrific, I mean, we could go. I mean, we could go on and on. I really want to thank Rob and Kevin and Judy and Jordan and Kevin. This has been a terrific conversation. Thank you very, very much.